By way of introduction, so they teach us in public speaking class, if you've taken that in college at all, or if you will, I don't know, but they tell you that when you build up a speech, there are really three parts to the speech. There's the intro, there's the body, the main part of the speech, and then there's the ending, the conclusion of the speech, where you really wrap it all up and tie it all together. I think a sign of a genuine speech is when the introduction and the body, and obviously the conclusion, are all really intertwined one with another. That's not to say that if your introduction is completely and totally irrelevant, that it's not a good speech, because most of the time, a high percentage of the time, the introduction really doesn't have so much to do with the body of the speech, which is okay, which is what is meant to be. But sometimes you have it where the introduction and the introductory remarks are really part and parcel to the message that you want to share. And I think that's a sign of a genuine message, of a real message, of a message that's coming from the heart, of one that's been thought out and is really appropriate for the time. So we have one of those that we're going to get to over the next few minutes. I think I'll give a few words of introduction, but I really think that this introduction is, in fact, the main point that I want to speak about, as you'll see in just a few minutes. First of all, just to notice and to acknowledge, to point out how lucky and how fortunate we are to be able to do this. Almost 2 years ago, when the pandemic, when Corona started, so there were a lot of challenges and a lot of things that got in our way, and a lot of negativity, a lot of things that stopped our normal routine. Challenges, again, and not to minimize any of those challenges or pains or suffering that people went through, which was real and legit. But there were some points of light. There were some points that we were able to take away, some positive things that we were able to take out of that experience. Mainly, I'm speaking about that initial experience. And that is the world of Zoom and the world of technology. The fact that it normalized getting together in this type of setting, while it might not be the most ideal way to teach and learn, and while it might not be the preferred way for people to communicate, again, I agree. I am all on team in person, and I think it's better to learn in person, and it's easier to learn in person, both as a teacher and as a student. It's easier and better and more genuine to learn in person. But this does, we can't go without acknowledging the opportunities that this gives us, the opportunity it gives us to do long distance learning, to connect, to share some ideas, to spend some time together, looking at each other, hearing each other, even though we are 6,000 miles apart. That is definitely a positive and a point of light that we shouldn't go without acknowledging this morning here. The second point of introduction that I want to make and acknowledge is you guys. A few weeks ago, we read in Parshas Mishpatim after Matan Torah about the giving of the Torah and the whole great event that happened at Har Sinai. And the Jews' emphatic response, the Jews' response to all of that and their charge is the famous words of Na'aseh V'nishma. The Jews answer back when God asks, do you want the Torah? The Midrash says that God went around to all the nations. And when he got to the Jewish people, when he got to Bnei Yisrael said, Na'aseh V'nishma. And the Chazal give us a tremendous amount of praise for Na'aseh V'nishma, for those words, for coming back and saying Na'aseh V'nishma. Chazal say that there were 600,000 malachim that came down and they placed a crown on every single head, every single Jew, one for Na'aseh, one for Nishma. And we had these crowns on our heads for saying Na'aseh V'nishma. And the question that many are bothered by and many ask is, what does Na'aseh V'nishma really mean? How is it possible? Why is Na'aseh V'nishma even a good, a positive thing? You would think if you have, for example, you take a basketball coach, right? And he says, he takes his player under his, puts an arm around his shoulder and he says, listen, son, you ready to go? You ready to play? And the guy says to him, yeah, I will play and then I'll listen to you. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? That is probably not a good thing. That's not what the coach wants to hear. Right? The coach wants you to go into the huddle, to listen to the plays, to learn the system, to learn the offense, to learn about the defense, to be a nishma, to be someone who's listening, to hearing, and then, only then, nasa, only then to execute the plan that we made. In general, for life, nasa v'nishma is not a winning plan. Most people do not succeed when they do not set an ishvah. If you do before you listen, if you do before you hear, if you do before you plan, that doesn't always end up in the place. That's not a recipe for success. That's not always what we're not going to end up where we think or where we imagine, where we want or desire to end up from that. So what exactly is so great about Na'aseh v'Nishma? What exactly does it mean? How can someone do before they hear? How can you do the Torah? How can you perform the Torah without hearing it first? So what does it mean? Is it good? Is it bad? There are many explanations given for it. But the Radomsker Rebbe, Rav Shlomo Rabinowitz, gives an incredible explanation in his Sefer on Mo'adim. This can be found in the section of Shavuos. He gives an incredible explanation. He says, Na'aseh v'Nishma is a two-step process. Na'aseh is the act of accepting the Torah, of listening to it, to hearing it, and to actually doing it, to bring it into reality, to actually going ahead and going through the motions and doing. Na'aseh represents listening and doing. So what's Nishma? What's Na'aseh v'Nishma? What's the Nishma? So the Radomsker Rebbe explains that the Nishma are people who, after they listen, after they perform, after they did, they go ahead and they act, they listen again. They come back for more. Right? After they listen and after they did the action, after they heard what the Torah wanted them to do, and they did what the Torah expected of them, they came back to hear more. They came back to do more. They couldn't get enough of it. They heard God's word and they said, I want more of this. Give me, right? I need some more from where that comes from. I need some more of that in my life. Right? They weren't just doing it. They weren't just putting a check in the checkbox. They weren't just doing it because they had to and it was expected of them. And then they ran away as quickly as possible. But they did it and then they came back for more. They did it, and there are two different ways to view the mitzvot. Some of us, unfortunately, view the mitzvot as a checkbox. This is what is expected from me. This is what my parents, my rabbis, God, this is what people, my friends want me to do, and therefore I'm going to do it. But when I'm done, I'm running as far away as possible. Now, I'll put on my tefillin, but I could not be farther from tefillin. I'll keep Shabbos, but the second Shabbos is over, I'm running back to my phone because Shabbos, it's a checklist for me. I did it. Been there, done that, and I'm good for the next 6 days. Or there's a person who says he's a Na'aseh v'Nishma type Jew. He keeps Shabbos, and then he comes back. I'm motivated. Where can I get more of that? Right? How can I extend Shabbos? How can I take Shabbos into my week? I'm looking forward to the next time I can keep Shabbos. That's a Na'aseh v'Nishma type Jew. Someone who does it, hears, does what he needs to do, and then is looking, comes back to do more. And the people who are here on a Sunday morning at 10:30, 10:45 a.m., or whatever time it is, wherever you are, that's a Na'aseh v'Nishma type Jew. Those are people who aren't just looking to check boxes. You didn't just go to yeshiva and you're done with it, but you're a person who is Na'aseh v'Nishma. You did it. You did what was expected for you. You did your Shema, your Shabbat, whatever it may be, and you're back for more. You're back to listen on a Sunday morning when you're off on a relaxing day, and you're taking time out of your day and out of your busy schedule. I know there are many, many places and many other things that you could be doing with your time right now, but you're choosing it to spend time with a Rebbe, to spend time with friends, to spend time learning some more Torah. And that is a Na'aseh v'Nishma type of Jew, of realizing that you're not just here to put a check in the box and to say, I did it, and to run far away, but to come back for more and to listen to more and to hear more and to get more from where it came from. And that is a beautiful thing. And I give you a lot of credit for doing that. And it's a schus for me to be in such a chavra, to be with a group of guys who spend their Sunday mornings learning, who spend their time when they could be doing other things and of their own choice when they decide to come and to spend time learning and gathering together. That's a group that I want to be a part of, that I'm proud to be a part of. And it's a privilege to share a thought with you over the next few minutes. That, as I mentioned, over the course of the past few years, we learned a lot. The pandemic has taught us a lot. One of the things that also came out, besides the Zoom technology and all of this long distance type of learning, but we also, we've witnessed what I like to call the eruption of Jewish podcasts. Podcasts have burst and have come onto the scene really primarily over the past 2 years. There have been many, many Jewish podcasts, educators about education, about whole sorts of things. Jews who get together and discuss, they discuss people, they discuss concepts. Right? You can find Jewish podcasts on almost anything. And again, it started, but it really took off and it really launched when people were locked up at home and people couldn't get together. So people started watching and listening on commutes later, and when people were starting to move, you commute to work. Which podcasts are you listening to? And there are countless of Jewish podcasts. Again, learning, educational, work, a million different Jewish podcasts out there that people listen to. One of the podcasts that I was listening to a few months ago had on a guest. I believe this was the Behind the Bima podcast or like Ephraim Goldberg. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it or not, but he had on a guest. It was actually two guests. It was a couple. It was an older couple. They were actually just turned 100 years old. One of them just turned 100 years old. The other one was turning 100 years old in a few weeks. And they were celebrating their 80th anniversary. I'll repeat that. They were celebrating their 80th anniversary. Two 100-year-old people, man and a woman, who were celebrating their 80th anniversary. Those are numbers that are hard to fathom. I wish it upon all of us that we should be able to get married, live until 100, and be married for 80 years. That is surely an impressive feat. And they were asking him many questions about what it's like being married for 80 years, different lessons and tips that he would give to the younger generation, especially us who have trouble focusing even for a short amount of time. Right? We go in the age of technology from one thing to the next thing in the snap of a finger. Right? It's hard to imagine doing anything for 8 minutes, let alone for 80 years. And they were asking, they're interviewing him and his wife, asking him these questions. And one of the few tips that he gave was that if you want to be young, if you want to stay young, you need to act like you're young. In order to be young, in order to stay young, you need to be young. Hang out with young people, do things that young people will do, act, be active. And one of the examples he gave, which I very much agree with and I very much second, is that one of the things that he said, well, these were one of his tips. If you are in a place that has stairs or an elevator, take the stairs. You want to be young? This is what a 100-year-old man said. You want to be young? You want to stay young? You don't want to feel like an old man? Instead of taking the elevator, take the stairs. I very much second that, even though I'm not the most active person. I could be lazy at times. But if you're in the building, right? I always say, you're in the Eish HaTorah building. Elevator or stairs? Take the stairs. That is one way to stay young. If you want to stay young, you should be young. You should act young, and that's an important lesson and something that we can that we can learn. And that's what we're going to be talking about over the next little bit. In this week's parasha, Parshas Truma, we read about all of the building of the Mishkan. We read about the actual structure, the different kelim, and the different vessels that were found in the Mishkan. The Mishkan was broken into two compartments, two parts. We had the Kodesh, which housed most of the vessels. And then we had the Kodesh Kedoshim, the Holies of Holies. In the Holies of Holies, as I'm sure you know, was the Aron Kodesh. And the Torah tells us that on the Aron Kodesh, there was a piece that was called the Kruvim. The Kruvim were two pieces that were facing each other. Chazal tell us that one represented Bnei Yisrael, one represented the Bnei Yisrael, the Jewish people, and the other one represented HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When they were at peace, when the Jews were doing the Ratzon of Hashem, the will of God, so they were close together, they were hugging. However, when the Jews kind of distanced themselves, when they weren't doing the will of God, so they separated, it was a way to show the Jewish people's connection to God at any particular moment. The Gemara in Sukkah and Chazal discuss why exactly were the Kruvim called the Kruvim? Where did they get their name from? And the Gemara in Sukkah tells us that the word Kruvim comes from the Aramaic word of Keravia. That the Kruvim were Keravia. What's Keravia? The Aramaic word Keravia, if you look it up, you'll find means babies. Keravia means like a baby. Why were the Kruvim called the Kruvim? Because of Keravia. Why baby? What does the Kruvim have to do with the babies? So Chazal tell us that the Kruvim had a face of the babies. Engraved in the Kruvim were baby faces. Now this seems like a little bit odd and a little bit strange. So we explained why the Kruvim are called Kruvim. Put a check next to that box. We've learned something new today. Right? The Kruvim were called Kruvim because they had baby faces. But why would you have baby faces in on top of the Arun, in the Kodesh HaKadosh, in the holiest of places? That is a little bit of a strange thing to do, a strange thing to have. Again, I understand that we have the Arun Kodesh, we have the Luchos, we have the Torah that are housed in the Kodesh Kedashim. And on top of that, you have the Kruvim, you have these sculptures, which are there to represent the connection between man, between Bnei Israel and God. But why baby faces? What is the significance of it? But why would we have baby faces in the Holy of Holies? You know, a little bit ago, also, again, probably about 2-3 years ago at this point, they came up with this face app. Right, this face app where you were able to put your face, right? It took a picture of you, you went into the app, you took a picture, and it allowed you to make yourself very old, right? It added a few wrinkles to your face, a few white hairs, right? And actually some of the pictures looked pretty accurate of what, if you wanted to know what you would look like or how you would look, your estimate based on your looks right now, how you would look in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you were able to see it on the app. Another feature that the app had was to make your face younger, a baby face, to turn your face into the baby face, right? Imagine taking that and plastering that on the Arun Kodesh, on top of the Luchos, in the Kodesh HaKadosh. Why? That's a strange thing to do. It's a strange place to have the picture of babies. So there are a few examples, a few answers given in the Mefarshim as to why there were baby faces on the Kruvim, on top of the Arun in the Kodesh Kodesh. The Torah Tamima, who is a commentary, he collects all of the works, all of the Gemaras on the Psukim and brings them. It is an incredible work by Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein. He gives the following explanation. He says that babies represent love. Babies represent a certain amount of care, a certain amount of compassion that people have. When people see babies, they normally, usually, it musters up a certain sense of love, of care, of smiley. People are usually kinder. It brings out the best in them. Right? People are not mean. People are not obnoxious to babies. When you see a baby, you smile a little bit. You'll give it a nice little wave, a nice little smile, a wink maybe. Right? People are friendlier and people are usually happier, a little bit brighter around babies. I actually had a debate with my wife sometimes. This is one of the things that that we don't agree on. But when we are in Ever, we've had the, I guess, I don't know what to call it, but we've traveled a few times, quite a few times with our children. We've gone through the airport, been on flights a handful of times with our children. And I am of the mindset that whenever we go into the airport, I try to use our children to get us to the front of the line. Not in a mean way, but we go. I'll go over to the person in the front. If it's a very long line in the airport, I'll say, listen, we have a kid. We have two kids here. They're small children. They're going to lose it, right? I don't want to bother anyone here. If they just sit here on the line crying, it's not going to be good. We have a long 12-hour flight ahead of us. Do you mind? And my wife always tells me that's not so nice. That's not so appropriate to cut the line. Again, if we need to, if they're really going crazy, but to pinch your baby, to get them to cry, to get to the front of the line, that's not the right thing to do. So God forbid, I wouldn't pinch my baby. But I go even without that. I'll go to the front and say, we have two kids. Can we come? Can you open a separate line for us? And honestly, most of the time it works. Most of the time, they'll clear the line for us. They'll open us a new line. They'll tell us to come around. And they'll give us special treatment because of our children. If I tried that by myself, that would not work. Going to the front of the line and asking them to open it up for me. I haven't tried it, but I don't think that would work. But again, but babies in particular bring out a certain care, a certain compassion, a certain smile, and a certain positivity to them. And the Torah Tamima explains that is why the Kruvim had the faces of babies on them. That's why there were baby faces in the Kodesh Kodesh on top of the Torah. Because the Torah is supposed to bring those same emotions. The Torah is supposed to bring that happiness, that positivity. The Torah is supposed to bring out the best of people. It's supposed to bring out the best of you, and it is supposed to bring out the best of the people around you. A Talmid Chacham, someone who's walking in the streets, he is supposed to not be, right, people aren't supposed to hate him. People aren't supposed to have some dislike and disfavor towards flavor towards him. But a person is supposed to connect to him. A person is supposed to be, to want, desire to be close to him. A person in yeshiva who's growing and learning in Torah is supposed to become a better person as well. His midos are supposed to be refined. The Torah is supposed to make a person a better person. The Torah is supposed to connect a person. The Torah is supposed to, again, make a person someone who people want to be around. A person who's struggling with his midos, a person who's struggling with his character traits, the cure for that should be go learn Torah. The cure for the Torah is supposed to make a person a better person. It shouldn't be chas v'shalom that a person learns Torah and he becomes more of a big shot. He becomes more arrogant. He feels more entitled. That's not what Torah is supposed to be. That's not what Torah is supposed to represent. But Torah is supposed to bring out the best of us and bring out the best of people around us. That is the explanation of the Torah to me. There is another explanation. This explanation comes from the Altar of Kelm. The Altar of Kelm explains something extraordinary. He says there are a few character traits of babies that we should all pick up on and we should all try to emulate. He says the way a baby learns, the way a baby goes about life is with a certain sense of innocence, a certain sense of excitement, a curiosity, a desire to learn and to grow. Too often, we approach Torah, we approach learning with a sense of entitlement, with a sense of deservingness, with a preconceived notion, right? With the idea that we are supposed to have everything, we're supposed to know everything, that we come with a certain sense of arrogance. The Altar of Kelm explained that Torah, the baby faces, represent the way in which we are supposed to learn Torah. With a certain level of humility, with a certain level of hisbatlus, of nullifying ourselves, lowering ourselves to the Torah, to the Rabbeim, and to HaKadosh Baruch Hu who is standing in front of us. Rabbi Berkowitz, our Rosh Yeshiva, he likes to say, and I've heard him quote on many occasions, the idea and the concept of people living in a world with preconceived notions. Most recently, a few weeks ago, we read about Parshas B'Shalach, about the splitting of the sea, the great miracle of Kriyas Yamsa. And Rabbi Berkowitz spoke about it in his Parshas here, about how just as great as the miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf was, of the actual sea splitting, was the fact that the Mitzrim, who were chasing the Jewish people, who were chasing Bnei Israel, they actually followed straight in without noticing that the sea split. Can you imagine how crazy that it was? If you were a Mitzri, if you were in Egypt, right, an Egyptian soldier who was running after the Jewish people, and they were stuck up, you saw, they were stuck up against Yamsuf, they were stuck up against the sea with nowhere to go, no places to turn, no direction to go and then to escape. And all of a sudden the sea splits and they run right through, right? Your reaction, I hope, would be, oh my goodness, right? That's crazy. Right? The sea just split. You would call your friend, you would take a picture, you would do something to acknowledge the fact that something miraculous, something crazy, something out of the ordinary just happened. But if you look in the Psukim, if you look in the story of the Torah, that's not what happened. The Mitzrim saw the Jews were pressed against the sea. They had nowhere to go, nowhere to turn. The sea splits for them. And what do? They run right after them. They run right in without stopping for a second, without missing a beat. They were so convinced that this was the reality. And that this was, they were supposed to go ahead and capture the Jewish people. They were so convinced that that's what they needed to do. They were so hyper-focused. They didn't look left or right. They didn't see anything. They missed the fact that the sea split. They missed the fact that that something happened. God was showing them something. God was sending them a message. Maybe that's not right. Maybe you shouldn't be running after the Jewish people. There is another reality, but they were so focused on their reality. They were so focused on their world. They were so focused on what they were trying to accomplish that they didn't leave room for God or for anything else. They lived in a world with a preconceived notion of this is the way it is supposed to be, and there were no other ulterior. There was nothing else. There were no other options. There were no alternate plans or possibilities. And the Altar of Kelm explains, if that is our approach to Torah, then we're in trouble. We need to take the approach of the babies, the innocence, the desire to learn, to grow, to question, to learn and to become better people. The ability to take in a story in Torah. Rav Rivlin, Rav Avram Rivlin, the former Mashkiach of Karen Biyam, where I had the privilege of learning, he used to say that we have a problem with learning Tanakh. And our problem with learning Tanakh is the fact that we know the ending. We know it's going to happen. It blinds us from so much of the story. If you were able to open up a Tanakh, if you were able to learn the stories in the Chumash without knowing what happened, you'd pick up on so much more. But because we know what's going to happen, because we were taught this in kindergarten, right, we can say backwards and forwards, that actually takes away for our appreciation, our understanding of what actually happened. We're stuck with the four-year-old version of the stories, and we're not able to see past that. We have these preconceived notions of this is what is going to happen. We know the end, and therefore it's hard for us to experience and actually appreciate the nuances and the details of it. A person, when they're learning Torah, needs to have the innocence of a child, the innocence of a baby. And that's why, says the author of Kalam, where the Kruvim, which are placed on top of the Aron, in the Kodesh HaKadashim, why they had baby faces on. Because we need the Torah that we can't approach it with a sense of arrogance. We can't approach it with a sense of entitlement. But and we need to approach it with a sense of humility, with a sense of innocence, with a sense of hisbatlus towards it, a sense of tmimus towards the Torah and towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu when we are learning it. It's interesting, we mentioned before, a Talmud Chacham, the way we refer to a Talmud Chacham, the way we refer to a scholar of the highest levels, one who has achieved some of the greatest accomplishments in learning in Judaism, we refer to them as a Talmud Chacham. Those words, what is that? Right? A Talmud is a student. A Chacham is a smart student. But a Talmud Chacham is we refer to the highest levels, the biggest Rabbanim, the most accomplished learners as Talmidei Chacham, as people who are students, people who view themselves as small, people who view themselves as continuing to learn, people who view themselves as continuing to grow, people who don't feel on top of the world. They don't feel like they're the biggest rabbis, but they view themselves as talmidim. They view themselves as students. They have a certain sense of innocence, a certain sense of humility, which they are keeping. They keep on learning, and it doesn't stop at any point. It doesn't stop after Shana Aleph. It doesn't stop after Shana Bet. It doesn't stop when you're 30. It doesn't stop when you're 40. It doesn't stop when you're 80. This idea and this concept of talmid, of a child, we need to channel that at all points and at all moments in our lives. Wherever we find ourselves, at whatever stage in life, we need to find that and to continue growing, to ask the questions, and not to feel like we have all the answers, to continue to grow, to realize where we are, and to realize that there's so much more that we can accomplish. And this comes full circle with what we started with, as I promised you with the introduction, right? With people who come out on a Sunday morning, people who are looking to grow. Those are people, right, who view themselves, who are able to channel that inner child, to channel that baby face on the Kruvim, who are able to come out and say, I'm not done. I'm still learning. I'm still looking to grow. I'm still asking. I'm still looking to better myself. And the Mirtzah Hashem, we should all be Zofa, to continue to do that, to continue to have that midah of the baby faces, of the child on the Kruvim in the Kodesh HaKadashim, and to continue to look for answers, to continue to ask questions, to continue to grow the sense of humility and a sense of connection to the Torah and Hashem, the ultimate creator. Thank you guys so much for coming.